last 18 months have been a challenge for many industries, and this was no exception for the overall automotive and transportation ecosystem. But the industry has proven to be very resilient in the past few months by continuing to pursue long-term goals for product and process innovation. We see a strong shift towards vehicle electrification as nearly every OEM transfers their portfolio and as legislation pushes new bans for combustion engine cars. As the electric vehicle leaves the early adopter phase, it will be welcomed by a broad audience of very excited customers. But what about that other massive trend? What about autonomous vehicle development? With EV plans coming to fruition, are companies refocusing their efforts on AVs? And what is the outlook for these AV programs? What are the challenges and how do they overcome them? Today, we will seek to answer these questions and more as we chat with a pair of seasoned industry experts. Nand Kochhar, VP of Automotive and Transportation Industries, and Matthew Wurm, Director of Autonomous Vehicles, both of Siemens Digital Industries Software. Nand, let me start off with you.
Thank you, Connor. Pandemic, of course, in the initial phase was a little bit of a disruption as people had to figure out how are we going to handle working remotely away from their offices, connectivity of when you start working remotely, things of that nature. So I would say those were generic. The entire automotive and transportation industry had to quickly relearn, wasn't specific to AV, but AV development was a part of that process of the pandemic. However, a few good things happened. Number one, in my mind, pandemic helped companies realize that the power of digital way of doing things. So the companies which were on digital transformation journey, they already had infrastructure in place. They had the software solutions for developing their vehicles in place. They were able to adapt quickly. And that also did one great thing, which was the reliance on simulation part of the autonomous vehicle development. And so I think that very positive things came out of something which was not all that positive, pandemic, that the reliance on simulation, trust on simulation increased. Being practical, however, it did impact the physical testing environment as people had to move away from the labs or proving grounds initially till there was an understanding of and the CDC guidelines or in every country, the country-specific guidelines of social distancing and things of that nature. So it did have an impact on the physical testing and development part of it for a short period of time.
Excellent. And you hit on this already, but did you see any changes in how we can make AVs a reality? Any changes to the timeline?
Yeah, of course. Making AVs a reality, there are several things happening or continue to happen along the way. First of all, is the technology. Technology continues to mature. As you know, AV, you can divvy up into three key parts: sense, think, and act. The senses are the perception, what our eyes do when there is a human as a driver. So as you know, the technology in terms of cameras, LiDAR, radars, that continues to mature to a great level that companies are relying either just on cameras and the perception algorithms continue to improve. So that's a big enabler. Same thing in the thinking process. There's a whole host of technologies for the second piece, which is processing of the information and a decision making of that information. So that one is technologies like 5G, technologies, the computing power, connectivity, everything happening through cloud. Automobiles running, working in a shadow mode, so they are in a continuous learning environment through artificial intelligence and machine learning. So all those technologies, which on their own might not mean anything, but when you pull them all together, are the huge enablers for autonomous vehicle development. And then same thing carries into the ACT piece of it. The cars are the automobiles. Any of the transportation systems are not just pure mechanical anymore. There's a huge electromechanical piece, electrical electronics, also powered by the software. So that is continues to improve and allows us to do the AV development in reality.
And Matthew, do you have anything to add there?
Yeah, I think the second part of your question was then the impact on the timeline. I tried to find evidence of a slowdown in the development, but actually did not yet find any proof points. So definitely there have been some initial articles last year, in summer last year, that investments in autonomous vehicle technology would be reduced, while investments in electric vehicles would be increased. But in practice, I've seen still a very active market, still new partnerships being announced, still new investments being made, and also new technological breakthroughs being presented. So honestly, I did not see yet a true proof point that the timeline has been infected.
Interesting. And so then how about consumer demand? Has consumer interest changed or faded at all?
On the consumer front, I think there's still a strong interest, and that's primarily coming from acceptance of technologies in general. As you know, a certain level of autonomy is already on the roads, and there's more and more acceptance, and the benefits of having an autonomous vehicles, they haven't faded away. So I think the consumer demand remains strong, and when the next generation of people come in and buying automobiles are experiencing the journey on the automobiles, I think continue to have an interest in that. Obviously, there's not really a one answer for the whole world. It is also depends on regions, people in Asia Pacific versus European region versus Americas might have in a different environment from a policies, from legal requirements, and the consumer interest go with that, better risk-taking ability, or adaption of technologies, I should say. People have different level of acceptance. So those factors play a big role as well in terms of accepting of these technologies.
It's not necessarily interest as much as just getting people used to the idea of of a self-driving car. Is that true?
Yeah. I mean, people have to feel comfortable, and people need to be assured that it's going to be a safe journey. Safety, as you know, is a big factor in that. So it is an acceptance of technologies, and the cultural does play a role, and that's why I gave a different view on the different regions, because in general, certain parts of the world are even, in fact, some specific countries, people are more open to adapting to the new technologies, adapting to autonomous vehicle, adapting to electrification as an example. So not everyone in the world is on the same level of acceptance. Obviously, some are leaders and the other are quick followers. And then slowly everyone else adapts those technologies.
And I think another indicator is that right now, self-driving capabilities in highway pilots are typically very expensive options at cars, multi-thousand dollar or euro options, but people are willing to pay for that. So there is a willingness to pay for self-driving technology, even on privately sold vehicles.
Could you speak to the different levels of autonomy and where we're at currently, maybe for listeners who aren't aware of the spectrum of autonomy?
In general, people use the SAE levels of automation, as defined by the SAE organization, ranging from 0 to 5, where 0 is pure manual driving, and level 5 is automated driving under all conditions and to every destination that you can think of. And then there's these intermediate steps, 1, 2, 3, and 4. Today, we are roughly at level 2, especially at premium vehicles. And level 2 means that there is some automation, like autonomous emergency braking systems, that will activate the brakes in case of a pedestrian that appears in front of the vehicle without any action from the driver. So that is kind of pure autonomy, but it's under very limited conditions. And the driver is always responsible under all conditions and needs to have his eyes on the road at all times. Whereas if we move to level 3, that starts to shift. And under specific conditions, like a highway pilot, it might be possible to close your eyes or read a book and don't pay attention to traffic. But at the same time, under all other conditions, then that specific highway scenario, you are still the one to drive the vehicle. Level 4 vehicles can bring you from A to B, but in a limited operational design domain, as they call it. And then finally, level 5 is then where that operational design domain in theory, gets rid of all its boundaries, which I think is a fairly potentially impossible automation level.
I think that's a really interesting thing to think about in the future, is whether that level five is ever truly possible.
Yeah, absolutely. And as I said, I honestly believe that it won't be, or at least it will take decades before we reach that. And up to that point, we will achieve for sure very high levels of automation, and making the drive from one city to another city within a certain country is definitely feasible. But to travel between countries, across borders, into different sets of regulation, into different types of infrastructure, that will be very tough, I think.
Currently, it sounds like most OEMs are right in the level two kind of capability range. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would agree to that. And Audi has last year presented a vehicle with level three highway pilot capabilities, but due to regulation, it was not possible to really bring that to market. I think it was in March this year that Honda has introduced on the Japanese market a level three system. So that would then, I believe, be the first production vehicle with level three automation.
And so then I'm curious, you know, what do we know about what it takes to safely increase these levels of automation in vehicles?
As you know, when you increase the level of autonomy, as Matthew mentioned, it's not about just the automobile at that time, because now your car has become connected, as it needs to be connected to the infrastructure. It needs to be connected to the other cars. So the whole host of things need to happen in order to have a safe journey. That's an important point which will help us move from level, whether it's from two to three and then from three to four, that looking at the entire infrastructure and the ecosystem of the automobile.
Matthew, do you have any other thoughts there on how we can safely increase these levels of automation?
Yeah, I think one prerequisite for increasing automation levels is a new development process at the industry side. What I typically use as an example is an adaptive cruise control system, which is a fairly advanced system. It maintains your speed at a highway. It maintains a certain distance to other vehicles. It reacts to new circumstances. New systems can help you change lanes automatically without any interference of yourself. These systems are verified on a proving ground with roughly 150 tests. So if you successfully pass these 150 test scenarios on the proving ground, the system is ready to be released and can go into production. And that's a level two automation. And that whole setup is built on the fact that there is always a driver as a backup solution for all other scenarios that might happen that the car is not capable of handling. If you move to level three, you can no longer rely on that driver taking care of all these unexpected scenarios. So that means that your testing, your verification process needs to be massively extended, either by driving endless numbers of miles and test kilometers with a large fleet of test cars, or through simulation. So that's step one. So a prerequisite for higher levels of automation is a development process that allows you to continuously test under a massive variety of conditions. The second part that needs to be in place to go to higher levels of automation is a closed loop development process, meaning that if you have released a specific software release and an accident happens or a series of accidents happen, you need to have the possibility to improve the software and do an over-the-air software update of all the vehicles on the road to make all systems perform better. And as long as the automotive industry in general does not have that capability in place and that engine, that closed loop, or as it is called, continuous integration, continuous deployment, development process, higher levels of automation will not become a reality.
That's really fascinating. And so you mentioned a new development process. I was wondering if you could elaborate on what that might look like.
The newness is mainly in the fact that you need to be, on one hand, support continuous integration and continuous deployment, meaning over-the-air software updates and even hardware updates could be planned in such a context. And the second thing that I believe is essential is a what we call in Siemens a chip-to-city perspective. And there is no longer a relationship between an OEM, a tier one supplier, and a tier two supplier, where it is one-way traffic, where the OEM puts his requirements on the table and where the suppliers have to deliver for the lowest price possible. It is a much more integrated machine. It's a computer on wheels where the chip maker and the traditional tier suppliers and the automotive OEM work on a centralized vehicle architecture that requires a centralized software stack, that requires cooperation across the boundaries of the of all the players in that supply chain. It's that closed loop element, and it is the chip-to-city element that I believe are critical ingredients of a new development process.
The approach is how you do this is through what's called model-based systems engineering. And since we touched on autonomous vehicles or any of the modern vehicles are no longer just the pure mechanical or hydraulic functionally operated, they're electromechanical. But even more important is the software piece, all kinds of software, whether it's embedded software or the application software, all that happening within the vehicle. So our answer from a model-based systems engineering is with a heavy emphasis on software. And we call that a software and systems engineering approach to solve all these complex issues. As you can imagine, moving from a traditional vehicle to an autonomous vehicle, the degree of complexity has increased exponentially. And so you need a new way of design and development and verification and validation. So that's why the systems engineering approach is absolutely critical and the key enabler.
Nand, what do you see as the technical limitations to what is currently possible? You know, where are the boundaries? And that could be in vehicles themselves or in these development approaches.
Again, you can divvy up technical boundaries or limitations of the growth needed in several categories. You could start with the most important pieces, having a EE architecture, electrical and electronics architecture in the vehicles. So as you can imagine, the traditional vehicles were starting with certain number of ECUs to do the decision making, and that number was growing exponentially. And now with the autonomous vehicle, there is a new way of looking at this, having a new architecture where you could have either a single processing unit or a multiple processing units by region within the car, section within the car. So that all calls for electronic and electrical architecture. Also, what we call software-oriented architecture, Matthew touched on, autonomous vehicles are possible so that you have over-the-air updates, both for the development phase as well as the maintenance or ongoing basis. So for example, you need a continuous learning for the development of autonomous vehicle. So you run, if you have a software architecture which will allow you to pick up all the data from the sensors while vehicles are being used, what's called the shadow mode, and then you can enhance any of those scenarios which we did not think about or the users did not think about, but the vehicle ended up experiencing. So you will have a record of that, and you will continue to enhance, or the algorithms will continue to enhance based on that learning. So, of course, to achieve that, you have a lot of artificial intelligence and the machine learning going on to deliver that. Then you look at it at computing power. Now we're talking of a massive data. So now you need a partition. How do you process all that information in the vehicle, on the cloud? And it becomes another challenge that you can't have terabytes of data all the time. So which data is valid? How do you pick a minimum set of data and still do the same amount of learning? So the whole thing about data analytics, computing power becomes a big thing. I think we talk things like over-the-air update, easy to say, but you need the entire mobility infrastructure in the autonomous vehicle as well, as you have to, the vehicles need to talk to the infrastructure, the lighting, traffic system, and the other vehicles, etc. So I think all those are the areas, as we grow the technologies, will help us deliver and continue to expand those boundaries to make AVs a reality.
Matthew, how do you see this all happening? For any company that's active in autonomous vehicle development, where do they start with this closed-loop development process we've talked about?
Trend from the past, say, 5 years, is that companies move away from having a simulation department that you call when you need a simulation. And particularly in the computational fluid dynamics domain, there is a strong heritage in having a team that you send your request to do a thermal or a aerodynamics analysis, and you get that done, and the simulation is done by the specialist, the simulation specialist. Whereas over the past 5 years, you see that simulation has become part of every engineer's job, rather than that you need a simulation specialist to run simulation. Every engineer that develops systems, whether it's mechanical, electrical, or software, uses modeling in one way or another. That's very important in that transition that I mentioned earlier. If you want to have higher levels of automation, you need scenario-based testing. And a big part of what NAND introduced as model-based systems engineering is that you run continuous verification based on scenarios. For the autonomous vehicle domain, that's really important. So having simulation embedded in the standard processes is step one. And step two is a transition towards automated testing of large numbers of scenarios. And I think the majority of the players in the automotive industry are currently working on that. So I think that's where we are in the timeline of that transition.
Do you see partnerships becoming an important part of this closed loop process?
Yeah, absolutely. First, independent of that closed loop process. So the amount of investments that are needed to develop full self-driving technology are even bigger than people thought them to be 10 years ago. So there is between 10 and 15 players worldwide that are dedicatedly developing level 4 self-driving stack. These companies spend a couple of billions a year. So massive amounts of money are needed to develop this true level 4 stacks. And having between 10 and 15 companies means that might still be too many, right? So we can actually expect some further consolidation in that domain to develop that technology, meaning that in the end, you have maybe 3 players in every region to develop a full self-driving car. So that consolidation takes place right now, took place over the past 5 years. You need to check the media on it, but there is every month big announcements like multi-billion dollar joint ventures or mergers or acquisitions. And below that, even more just partnerships and cooperation contracts. The big driver for partnerships first, I think, is the complexity of the technology and the amount of money that is needed to develop a full self-driving stack. And then relating it back to that closed loop development process. If the car becomes a car, it becomes a computer on wheels, and you want to treat it as a computer on wheels, you need cooperation across the borders of the individual players in the supply chain, and you need to build a much more integrated product. And we know Tesla has developed their own full self-driving chip, as they call it, where the full self-driving chip, by the way, still runs a level 2 ADAS, advanced driver assistance system. So it's definitely not a full self-driving vehicle yet. So that's really important to realize. VW also announced that they will, that they started designing their own chip. So they also consider the core chip to be the heart of the car of the future and no longer the powertrain or the chassis system as we've seen in the past 50 years. Whereas Volvo, Mercedes have put their eggs in the basket of NVIDIA to deliver that core compute platform and the capability to run these over-the-air software updates and that CI/CD development process that I just mentioned. Mm-hmm. So I think the industry is really searching for how to implement that closed-loop engineering process and the interaction with the end customers and the end users using these vehicles. And they truly rely on partnerships there.
NAND, how do you see these partnerships evolving? Are they strategic, exclusive partnerships with like a specific aim to co-develop throughout the upcoming number of years?
Yeah, I think I would say most of the partnerships I see are strategic when the announcements come out. Just the latest of this week, Magna buying Veoneer, one of the safety ones, just last couple of days. So as Matthew said, every day you hear a new partnerships, and they are really strategic in nature, because what's happening is the boundaries are blurring between technology companies and so-called traditional OEMs. they're also blurring between tier one, tier two suppliers to the car manufacturers. At the same time, you also have startups. Startups are writing their own rules because they have no legacy information or legacy processes to worry about, and they don't have to worry about the current production. So you can see there's a whole host of things going on. Here's a very traditional 100-plus-year-old product development, manufacturing organizations. Their problems, what they need to solve, are a little bit different than a startup, than a tier one is trying to grow, become a totally integrated. And that's why I think some of the things, partnerships are absolutely critical. Because in my mind, no single person, doesn't matter how large of an organization it is not able to solve this level of complex problems on their own. So I think they all are extending hands very strategically, what they think their gap is, what they can do on their own, and what they need to partner with someone and grow strategically to deliver the end objective of delivering an autonomous vehicle for the end consumer, or developing a new business model. It might not even be a regular consumer the way we have consumer today. It could be all a fleet operator, and that gives a new business model. That's how I see it, partnerships maturing and continuing to mature as we go forward.
And by the way, I think there is an analogy with our own company. So as Siemens has been very strategically acquiring companies, building this new digital industry software company, mm-hmm. and I think so Siemens is the only one right now that can digitize from, hey, if I focus on the automotive domain, we can digitize the chip, we can digitize sensors, environmental models, controllers, E&E architectures, individual ECUs. We can digitize then at the level of the vehicle, the chassis systems, the vehicle dynamics behavior, the powertrain behavior. We can put that vehicle in a digital environment. And not only we have that digital threat, but we also add to that the test component, so the physical testing and the data acquisition systems that are needed to collect the sensor data and to really close that loop that we referred to before. I think it's tough to claim that Siemens could be an indicator of the global trends, but maybe it is, right? Siemens is definitely one of the, we're number 11, I think, in most innovative companies in the world last month in the BCG analysis. It's not completely out of whack to look at ourselves and see ourselves as an indicator of this trend, where mechatronic system development can no longer be handled by an EDA company, a CAD company, and a simulation company. What you need is an integrated set of tools and development processes to tackle the challenges of the day.
Do you think these integrated tools, as you were just talking about, do you think that can help support these partnerships we've been talking about?
Yeah, I think it's essential. And I can refer to a customer discussion that we had over the past 6 months, where there is a new partnership announced between a traditional tier one and a traditional chip maker, where the chip maker has established development processes, verification processes for virtualization of chips, coverage-based testing approaches to ensure that you fully test all the almost infinite number of combinations of transistors that you can think of in that chip. And on the other end, the automotive industry that has a verification process going through model in the loop, hardware in the loop, software in the loop, vehicle in the loop, and proving ground testing and full vehicle testing on the road. The ISO 26262 functional safety standards, the automotive spice development processes. So it's a very different way of looking at verification and validation. It's a very different way of translating requirements into test cases, into conclusions. And suddenly these two worlds need to work together and they need to build an integrated product. And the nice thing of then being Siemens is that we can bring two people into the call that understand both the chip perspective as well as the vehicle development and system development perspective. And that we start to merge both worlds, and that we, for example, now can couple a chip emulator with a virtual vehicle in a virtual environment, and that we can develop load cases for that full self-driving chip, as Tesla calls it, or the next generation chip that VW will develop, a autonomous vehicle specific chip design that needs to handle autonomous vehicle-specific use cases, mean that we can help the chip industry with an environment to test the chip in the right context, whereas we can then help the automotive company reusing the same test suite and the same test cases to test the full vehicle performance afterwards. So it brings a lot of continuity throughout the supply chain and a lot of knowledge sharing and understanding of the different perspectives of the different players in these partnerships.
One of the other things that we need to address is that there are currently pretty limited regulations in place surrounding autonomous vehicles. So Nand, how do you see that evolving in future years, and how can the automotive industry play a role in the development of these new regulations?
Yeah, I mean, again, this is a new technologies, new areas. You always start from a regulatory perspective. That's where the word limited regulations exists. So it's a catch-22. Industry works with the regulators, for example, in North America, National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, or in Europe, you could work with the agencies like Euro NCAP, which gives the safety ratings of the today's vehicle for the passive safety. So one of the things these regulatory authorities have been doing is already starting to give a credit for level of autonomy in their cars or the features which are being offered in the cars to count towards that star rating system. So, for example, the autonomous emergency braking, if your vehicles have that, it gives a certain amount of credit or contributions towards the overall rating calculations. So I think in that way of looking at things, the technical organizations like Society of Automotive Engineers as a body across different OEMs or the automotive industry, whether it's a supplier, tier one supplier, or the OEMs themselves, have an opportunity to work with the agencies, show them the way, what they've been developing, testing, what their views are, and getting the authorities to buy into that and have that iterative process. That's how, in my experience, the past, let's say the safety regulations in every country, that's how they get developed, that you work hand in hand with the regulatory authorities, and then what's the art of possible? Where do we need to take the technology for the sake of larger good? For example, safety in general, what do we need to do? And that will continue to evolve. So industry plays an important role, and those regulations will continue to mature and get to a point that it is just like today's safety, passive safety regulations we have on the automotive industry.
Matthew, you already talked a little bit about the verification and validation of autonomous vehicles. Could you comment a little bit on how these systems are going to be validated against these new regulations that are going to be developed?
The first step, and that's what you also see in the new protocols that are being developed, for example, by Euro NCAP, is a combination between virtual and physical testing. So where today all testing in these consumer tests is physical testing. So have very detailed protocols that describe how to execute a test, with which speeds, with which steering input, with which object that you drive towards. So a very tight set of boundary conditions to ensure that these tests are repeatable and to ensure that you can compare the performance of one vehicle to another. However, referring back to what we discussed earlier, with increasing levels of automation, the big challenge is not in reacting safely in a very specific and well-described scenario. The big challenge is in the large variety of scenarios that the vehicle needs to react to. What Euro NCAP envisions is that they describe a very large scope of possible conditions, that they ask the automotive industry to supply virtual results covering all those individual possible scenarios, and that they choose 10, 20, 30 specific cases out of these hundreds of cases to test on the proving ground and to repeat on the proving ground. So what the regulators look for is ways to extend the scope of possible testing conditions while at the same time ensuring comparable, repeatable test procedures. And that's a massive challenge. And I think even a bigger challenge is the fact that these over-the-air software updates have an impact on the safety performance of vehicles. There is a known Tesla update of the battery management system that impacted the braking distance of the vehicle. And the battery capacity is a contributor in these braking systems. So if you optimize for full battery charging, your braking capacity will be less. So there has been an adaptation in the battery management system to improve the braking distance of these vehicles. Now, that's such a fundamental safety performance indicator that you can question if a vehicle that got a one-time type approval, as we do today, and is allowed on the road, but gets software updates that in that way can impact the safety performance,
right,
that you also need continuous regulation, right, or a continuous homologation process. And the regulators definitely work on that. There's also discussions that we have with these institutions on how to handle that. And my bet is that also their virtual validation or virtual verification then will be a key element in proving out that your new software release is as safe as the release before was.
Taking everything we've talked about into consideration, what do you see, at least initially, as the most plausible scenarios for deploying autonomous vehicles at scale?
I think some of that is already happening today. And now the question is, how do we grow the scale? So in terms of technically speaking, we've been saying SAE levels of autonomy. And we said, yep, the next level is a SAE level 4 autonomy. And the examples of that would be robotaxis or the shared vehicles. And those are running into certain conditions are called the geofencing. So in other words, you have an operational domain, you put some kind of constraint, and under those conditions, those vehicles will be running. So, and it also depends on the other elements we touched on, the policy and the legal regulations and the openness of the legal system in a country. So the answer varies from region to region and country to country as well. In my mind, a short-term plausible way is growing the SAE level 4 vehicles, which are already running as pilots in several countries, including, let's say, in North America, and I think it's Phoenix area, Google running those vehicles where people sign up and people who are willing, they share the rides and they get picked up in those. In countries like Asia Pacific, several countries, they've got the robo-taxis. You can order a taxi under certain conditions. The geofence could be a certain city or within a city, a block. A good example, right in our backyard in Detroit, Ann Arbor area, I think Domino's Pizza had run pilots of delivering pizza, and that was the SAE level 4, but it was geofenced from certain locations to certain regions. So I think the maturity of that, as the technologies we talked on, that will continue to grow. So you will see a adaptation moving from level 3 to level 4 vehicle of autonomy all over the globe over a shorter period of time. That'll be the most plausible scenario.
Matthew, do you have any further thoughts on how these vehicles will be deployed and then scaled?
So I very much share the perspective that Nan just put on the table. What I hope is that the big value of self-driving vehicles is not in the self-driving part, right? The true value comes if we can improve our cities. And if you look at the city today, no matter where you are, you will see cars everywhere. Streets are packed with cars. There is specific parkings full of cars. There is traffic jams. There's people spending useless time in cars. There is research from Bosch that says that in urban environments, 30% of the driving time is spent on looking for parking places. It's that kind of nonsense that we have by now accepted as a reality and that we have accepted as being normal, which is not normal. And autonomous vehicles can really help that solving that issue. And if we can take away vehicles from the road by reducing the number of vehicles and share them with more people, the typical car is standing still for 95% of its time. So if we can just increase the usage of vehicles, if we can put vehicles where we don't see them, if they can automatically park themselves in an area, in a garage where we don't have them in front of our houses all the day, that would be excellent. And lastly, if we can share cars with multiple people, we will also have less kilometers driven in total. And that's, I think, where the true value of self-driving vehicles is. I hope that deployment of self-driving vehicles is not something that's just about increasing levels of automation in privately owned cars, but that it actually is the ignition of a change towards mobility as a service, where we really start to travel from A to B, rather than that we look for our next new car or status symbol.
You know, if I could reduce the amount of time I have to spend looking for just parking, I think that would be a a huge benefit to my life.
A massive win, right?
Yeah. Not to mention everything else that could come along with it. Guys, thank you so much for joining us today. I think this has been a really fascinating discussion. Nand, Matthew, thank you guys. And we will hopefully talk to you guys again soon.
Many thanks.
Yep. Thank you, Connor.
AV development programs are regaining momentum across the automotive industry. Progress is being made in many aspects: self-driving technology, public perception, and regulations or legislation to manage the deployment of AVs. While challenges remain, the industry can count on advanced closed-loop development methodologies to overcome any roadblocks along the way. I'd like to thank both of our experts for offering their insight today, and I do hope that you will join us again on The Future Car. Bye for now.